This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and try to turn them into stories that are actually good.
My name is Gabriel Urbina. I am your first Bad Ideas host.
My name is Zach Valenti, and I'm your other Bad Ideas host, because unfortunately our compatriot Sarah is unavailable.
She is taking some time to handle some things in her real non-internet-based life. She is the only one of us that still has one of those. But never fear, she'll be back shortly and filling in for our wayward host is one of our good podcasting friends, one of our favorite people on the internet. It's Taking Initiatives, Josh Perreault. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good and very flattered at the moment. I'm starting to feel how comfortable this Sarah Shackett missing chair is.
Isn't
it the second time? But
well,
you know,
it missed
a comfy
you. It's
chair.
Glad. It's glad to have you back.
Feels good. I mean, it's right. A different chair entirely because we're social distancing like responsible people, but it's a metaphorical chair, really.
But Josh, you're one of our few returning guests here at No Bad Ideas. You went through this ringer, you survived, and glutton for punishment, you have returned and gone, give me more bad ideas.
I'm a little bit masochistic in the way of storytelling. What can I say?
Our right on, kind right of on. People.
Yeah.
Storytelling yeah. masochists.
But it was such a great time last time. I saw there was a couple more guests that popped on. My friend Eugenio Vargas was a guest of yours at some point. That was pretty awesome. But I returned
awesome
for some
guest.
More. He's an awesome person. He's wonderful. But yeah, I would like to see what you guys brought to the table this time around and see if we can come up with even a better bad, I mean, good ideas.
That's right. Before we launch into all of that, though, and I am so impatient to launch into it because I am a big fan of the bad idea that I found this week. Josh, do you want to take a second to tell the folks at home about Taking Initiative and why that is and why they should be tuning into it?
Sure. Taking Initiative is a D&D 5e actual play podcast with audio drama tendencies. So we have a lot of scoring throughout. We have some sound effects here or there. We heavily edit the episodes to make it more of a condensed storytelling experience rather than just a
awesome.
Live play.
Well, thank you.
We really take a lot of effort to make sure it's higher quality because most of us are from post-production and we can't stand having something go out without us putting, you know, a lot of effort into it. So we take a lot of pride in what we put out. And for those who listen, we're glad you do. And for those who may come as newcomers and you start from the beginning, please know it gets better with audio, as does all podcasts.
I think that if you are familiar with me and Zach's own work, I think that there is a certain familiarity with that podcasting
the
learning.
Podcasting on ramp.
That's right.
It's mandatory. Yeah.
But we're in the middle of season two right now. We run the D&D 5e modules. The first one was Curse of Strahd, which I DM'd. And this time I put down the DM hat and I'm a player in Storm King's Thunder. So we are in the middle of that season now. And Bucky, who was a player in first season, is now the DM for that.
Dope.
Amazing.
And I know nobody interesting does the voice for any villains on the show. So definitely don't listen
guy.
For that.
Yeah, we have one guy back in season one. I can't quite remember his name.
You had to kill him off after a while, didn't you?
I mean,
because
spoilers
he did not
if I
play
needed
well
to.
With others.
Oh, it was Zach. Zach played Strahd in the first season and did a wonderful job with it. We also had a friend of your show as well, Kristen DiMercurio, as another voice in season
one. Oh, yeah.
One. We've had some guests here and there, and they've been wonderful.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, you should all definitely check out Taking Initiative. That's a good idea. Therefore, we will talk about it no more here on this episode. It is now time for us to turn to bad ideas. This is No Bad Ideas, the show where we find horrible, really underthought out things that people have done, and we bring them to our co-host and our guest, and we have just 10 minutes, just 10 very short minutes to try to turn these bad ideas into the pitch for a good story, or at least the beginning of the pitch for a good story. Are you guys ready to jump into this first bad idea?
Yes. Yes, I am. And you said we have 10 minutes?
10 minutes. Yeah. 10 minutes.
We're fine. We're good.
Based on your enthusiasm, Gabriel, I'm excited for this one.
No, so I found this article, and spoilers, I apologize in advance. This is going to be a slightly longer read than we normally do here on No Bad Ideas. I'm going to try to kind of blitz through it. But I found this article, and I went, oh my god, this has literally everything. Like, everything. This is just kind of one of those, like, it checks off so many of our recurring favorite things here on No Bad Ideas. So I'm very, very excited to share it with you guys. Dear listeners, if you would like to read along, we're going to have a link to the episode. A link to this article in the episode description. So, without further ado, from mercurynews.com, I present to you the bizarre story of a man who tried to murder a 600-year-old tree.
Okay.
Go on.
Oh, don't worry, Zach. It gets much stranger.
Just don't tell my ant friends.
So, in May 1989, a bizarre murder attempt in Austin, Texas, gripped the nation. The details of the case were unusual. The victim, Austin's oldest resident, a nearly 600-year-old tree known as Treaty Oak. Little bit of information about Treaty Oak and what kind of specimen it is, blah, 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 blah. It does not enormously matter other than it's a very big, very old tree. And thanks to a citywide fundraiser in the 1930s, the tree even owns the park it lives on. Quote, certainly there are not many trees, not just in Austin or in Texas, but in the world, that own their own land, said John Giddydratis, Austin's first city forester. When Giddydratis took on his role as a forester with the Parks Department in 1985, he was well acquainted with the Treaty Oak. Well, certainly we had several historic trees in Austin, he said, but the most important tree was Treaty Oak. Little bit more information. It is very important to the city. It is more important. It is very important to sort of several local Native American tribes who believe that this tree is sacred. Students take field trips to the tree. But then, one day, in 1989, Giddydratis was hosting a group of state foresters from across the country and took them on a tour of Austin's parks. When they got to Treaty Oak, they noticed dead grass on the ground surrounding the tree. I just assumed there was a park employee that got a little sloppy, said Giddydratis. I didn't give it a second thought. Months later, the tree continued to deteriorate, and the leaves began to show symptoms of chemical poisoning or herbicide.
Jesus.
So, right away, we dug up some of the soil and took some tissue samples and sent it off to the laboratory, Giddydratis said. A week or two later, we got the results back. The Treaty Oak had been poisoned. The poison detected was a powerful herbicide known as Velpar, manufactured by the chemical company DuPont and usually used to kill hardwoods on pine plantations. We knew it was an intentional poisoning, said Giddydratis. And that's when the fun started.
What?
Oh yeah, no, this is only getting ramped up. As far as Giddydratis knew, no one had ever tried to solve a problem like this one before. It began to make national news. Quote, it became the most famous tree in the world, Giddydratis recalled. Front page of the Times. It was in Sports Illustrated, People Magazine, National Geographic. It was on all the networks. People from all over the world became invested in this case. Quote, people started hearing about it, and one of the people to hear about it was H. Ross Perot, remembered Giddydratis. Perot was a billionaire and a business magnate based in Texas. He offered to help with the expenses of the investigation. He came to us and said, whatever it takes, however long it takes, you just send me the bill.
You found a story with someone's name that's mine?
Yes, I did. Just for you.
Oh, Gabrielle, I am touched. Go on, please.
With Perot's blank check in hand, Giri Dreides and his team went on to call every expert and scientist in their Rolodex. There follows a little bit of section about sort of some research that they tried to do. It was inconclusive. So that's when the police get involved. When it was first reported that the Treaty Oak had been vandalized, the Austin Police Department thought it was a joke. Quote, "I think a lot of folks viewed it as being beneath the dignity of the office," said John Jones, my favorite name in this story, a now retired detective for the police's for the city's police department. At the time, he was brand new to the job. After 13 years working as an undercover street cop, he had transitioned into the detective unit, and the Treaty Oak was his first case.
Wow.
Quote, "Criminal mischief is what the title was," John Jones remembered. "The Treaty Oak was the victim. They thought it was hilarious." Going on further ahead, a lot of different leads, a lot of strange tips from different people. It's all very amusing, but I kind of want to get us to like the really bad stuff at the end of this. As Treaty Oak continued to receive media coverage, a woman by the name of Cindy Blanco came forward, claiming to have information pertaining to the case. Blanco knew a man called Paul Stedman Cullen, with whom she carpooled to a local methadone clinic. During the car rides, Blanco said Cullen spoke about his love for his mental health counselor, who wasn't returning the same affections. Blanco alleged that Cullen had searched for books on witchcraft, looking for an anti-love spell to mend his broken heart. Although the ritual details he chose remain unclear, Blanco claimed that Cullen believed that by killing a living thing, he would also be killing the love in his heart.
Whoa.
The rest of the article is kind of a like actually like very fascinating read about how they entrapped this person and got them to sort of incriminate themselves, and how he served a 9-year sentence for the attempted murder of this tree. Spoilers and good news, the tree survived.
Whoa.
But
was he wrongly accused, or did he actually do this thing?
Oh, no, no, no. He maintained his innocence throughout the case. But eventually, because they got this woman who knew him to wear a wire and record several conversations that she had with him, he was found guilty and sentenced to 9 years in prison.
Wow. Oh, my God.
So that's basically, that's kind of like the bones. Again, it's a very long read, and I highly encourage anyone to go and read it. But that's what I have for you guys. Someone that, you know, like tree murder, detective's first case, bankrolled by one of the most, you know, rich guys in America, witchcraft, like it's all there. So let's see what we can do with this.
So
I'm setting 10 minutes on the clock.
Can we quickly back up to how a tree can own property?
Unclear. There was a fundraiser, and now the tree owns that property. That's kind of all the article says on that matter.
So
it must have had a stake in it.
Ooh.
LOL. Oh my gosh. Is it like a corporation is a person, and a tree can be a corporation? Like, I'm confused. But
I don't know what to tell you, Zach, but that tree owns that park.
We live in a world where trees can own parks. Great.
Oh, and I don't know if I said this in kind of my rush to get through this, but the tree is alive. The tree is well. The tree survived and continues to be a part of Austin. It is
what
Austin's
a fucking
oldest resident.
Story.
Yeah. Did you require GPS for the amount of turns you had in that, or were you good?
Well, again, it's one of these things where, like, you know, hearing No Bad Ideas, oftentimes we'll kind of go like, okay, that was the first half of the story, and I think that, like, the rest of this is interesting details, but we don't need it.
Yeah.
But here, the more that I kept going, the more it was like, H. Ross Perot is involved? What is going on? Detective's first case? Witchcraft? Broken hearts? Incrimination? Wires? What is happening in this article?
Wow. All right. There's a lot to pull from in this. Okay. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So like, where would you guys like to start with this?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind for me is that normally when you watch a story of where something is going on in a park or something, and then there's a really healthy tree after someone died, you find out that that's where they buried the body, and the tree is like
is like being... nourishing on the body. Yeah.
Right. And this is the exact opposite.
Right. Okay. Yes. So, yeah. You know, so like we have kind of like the inverse of that usual incriminating evidence sort of a stakeout situation.
Yeah.
Right.
Zach, where are you thinking with it, man?
Well, so my first question, being a big fan of the Ents in the Lord of the Rings series, is do we want to bring our tree to life and just like have like the mayor of this like small place in Texas be like Mr. Treebody? Or are we keeping it more close to reality where there are just dirty, dirty humans trying to kill trees for heartbreak profit?
Well, is this, or is this witchcraft causing the tree to become more alive?
Oh, it's taking on the life that, you know, this guy wants to kill out of his love affair. I see.
And so now we have a living tree on the loose. Like a humanoid.
Or like, you know, there's this very famous tree. It was there. He did this crime and he botched the spell or something. So that way he started to become the tree by transferring his life in, or gave it a life of its own. And now it's stuck in this place. So they started to give it property to own. I don't know exactly which way to go with this.
So that'd be like more of an, like, was it Andy McDowell? Like that, what was that show where the guy got turned into a dog because he was kind of an asshole?
100 Good Deeds for Andy McDowell.
That's the one. And so it's
heard of this. And this sounds bonkers. Excuse me?
It was a Nickelodeon show.
Guy got turned into a dog, had to do a bunch of good deeds to be turned back into a person. And
how did he work that out? Like, was he just like, well, I'm a dog now. I suppose karma must be involved.
I think it was more explicitly spelled out for the children.
Yeah, it was
watching.
Told to him, I think.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Got it.
So every episode was like a good deed that he did.
Right.
Yeah.
And so similarly,
I see.
This tree man would then have to, I guess, like make amends with his like feelings for people that he was trying to kill by killing a tree, but instead transferred his life into a tree and now needs to just like get over it in order to become a person again.
See, I would tweak that slightly, because the tree gets brought to life. The tree's a blank slate.
Yeah.
So I kind of like the idea of someone was trying to do the spell in order to not be in love with someone. The spell went awry. As a result of that, this tree comes to life. And maybe the tree becomes the way that apparently it is in real life, incredibly popular. The tree becomes the most popular resident in Austin. You know, it's like everybody wants him at their parties. Everyone is always happy to see, you know, old tree. But the person that cast that spell, they're still out there. They have unfinished business. And one day they may try to come back and finish the spell, which would take the life out of our very popular tree.
So this is also reminding me a little bit of like the Giving Tree. A little.
Yes.
So I know we normally like pick maybe a genre to go down. So are we going down more of this crime route, or would we want to lead this towards a fable in a way of like a kid's story for learning a lesson of how to handle your feelings?
I feel like if you have to ask, you want to go fable.
I guess.
Yeah,
you know, like the real story is such kind of a like bizarre episode of Law and Order.
Right.
I don't think that it needs to like go that direction. I'm intrigued by kind of putting in a different.
Yeah, that's a whole season of True Detective or whatever that show is.
You mean Tree Detective?
Exactly.
It's very fitting that a tree had a major part of that first season. I looked at a lot of that show. Yeah. I was the dailies tech for that show. It was a lot.
No
of
way.
Days.
Really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
I worked on the first season. It was awesome.
I'm sorry for your dreams, though. I imagine they were kind of dark at that time.
They were cool. It was all right.
All right.
The test footage was just fields burning. Anyway, let's move on.
3 minutes and 45 seconds remaining.
Oh, boy.
Oh, geez. So, okay. So the tree gets alive. So what is this tree teaching, or what is it learning in this process?
Well, I'm trying to think about sort of like what are kind of like a tree's values. And I'm guessing that it would sort of be very, someone that is very, almost has like a Buddhist perspective of kind of, you know, like you get things, things flow through you, and then you give things. You're not kind of meant to hold on to things and keep them forever, because that's kind of not the way the trees do. They have a certain resilience, but they're also just kind of like so connected to the cycles around them. So true. It's probably kind of going around helping a lot of people to learn lessons about greed and about the need to kind of be there for each other more than you're there for yourself, that kind of thing.
What if also this spell to get rid of the love for this person doesn't quite work for the human being?
Yeah.
So they decide to give up something else and then give up something else. Because nothing is working to get rid of these feelings that he has no control over. So he's gradually giving the tree more life until the tree becomes basically a person in themselves.
I love this idea. And I love this idea of this person thinks that they're in love with this person. They do a spell to give their love to this tree and they still feel the same way. And now it's a question of kind of like, well, if this isn't love, then what is it? You know, sort of like, what is the root of this thing that I'm feeling? And it's almost like they're just kind of like hacking off different parts of their emotional body until eventually the tree is more person than they are.
Does the tree fall in love with the person that they are in love with by some transitive property? Or does this person fall in love with the tree in the end?
I think the second is more likely.
Okay.
Because I think that if they were able to give the love to the tree, it would be like, ah, fucking finally, there, whatever, that's whatever it was. I can go home now and watch 101 Dalmatians. I don't know why that's the thing that came to mind. So I think
all the dogs in the park, they just want to be involved.
There you go. Boom. Exactly. So I think they need to kind of be stuck with like whatever is causing them to have these feelings for this person.
So what would be the ultimate... I guess not decision, but what happens to the person that gave away all their stuff? Do they eventually get it all back by the tree giving it back with like different fruit and such, and they become who they were at the beginning?
I think that's the way that it has to go. Like the tree receiveth and the tree giveth back.
Especially
if it's kind of in a like fable, parable sort of a format. I think it has to go that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at some point he eats of the apple of the tree of the knowledge that he is of his own knowledge.
Yes, of the knowledge of love and evil.
I guess the tree itself would represent growth and learning in a very physical way. And as you experiment and try things, you watch the effects that it has, and then you take the fruits of your labor very literally and become a better person at the end of it.
I want this children's book. In the 15 seconds that are left, what is it called?
Fruits of Labor.
Ooh, I really like that. That's great. And that is time.
Zach's on something. I see it. I see it. What are you on?
A tree to remember me? No. It's a swing and a miss.
It's all good. It's all right. Together, we succeeded.
Well done, you guys. That went to a very different direction than anything that I could have anticipated from that roller coaster of a story. But I love this. I think this is a great children's book waiting to happen.
I'm down for this. I really thought with the witchcraft and stuff, I'm like, all right, is this tree going to eat people? What's going to happen?
Right. The whomping willow goes wild.
Yeah. Oh. what a video series that is. Whomping Willow Goes Wild.
Let's consider the possibilities there with a certain amount of fear and horror.
NC-17.
And we'll be right back.
Hey y'all, Sarah here. I am breaking into the show. I'm not even in this episode, and I'm still breaking into the show to let you know about a fun new project that Team No Bad Ideas is involved in. You have probably heard us talk about this before, but we are so excited. We're going to keep sharing it with you. We have a new fiction podcast that we are getting ready to go into production in. It's called Unseen. It is our first fantasy series. It's going to be amazing. We have some incredible actors lined up for it. The scripts are being written. And if you would like to know more about this project, then you should head to its website. It's unseen.show. And you can sign up for a newsletter there that will give you all the information you need about when it's coming out, who's involved, all the nitty-gritty details. Again, that is unseen.show. We think it's something that you should be watching closely. There will be more soon. And there will be more of this episode of No Bad Ideas right now.
And we return, this time with a bad idea from yours truly. Hard act to follow,
all right.
Gabriel.
All right, Zach, what do you got? What do you got?
Well, your baby will not be beaten by this idea, but this idea is about babies. From Reuters.com, this is something that I'm so glad did not exist when I was a child. Smart Crib aims to help rock-a-bye baby. Oh, yes. This may seem like a good idea to people who like
It isn't.
Their vacuums to run themselves, but
no.
I beg you to see the badness. As every new parent knows, sleep can go out the window after the arrival of a newborn. That was certainly the case for parents Radhika and Bharath Patil, who, seeking relief for their own disrupted sleep patterns, put their electronic engineering backgrounds together to create the Smart Crib.
Oh, yeah. As a dad, I am excited.
Right.
All right, so what makes this crib so smart, Zach? Tell us.
Outsourcing. Their crib, powered by artificial intelligence, combines a baby monitor, rocker, bassinet, and crib in one. Quote, it's not the amount of work around the baby that tires the parents. It's the lack of sleep, Radhika Patil, Cradlewise chief executive, told Reuters in an interview. According to a recent study, new mothers lose an hour of sleep per night on average, and it can take them up to 6 years to regain pre-pregnancy sleep levels. It was for their first child that the Patils built the Cradlewise Smart Crib using a patented silent rocking mechanism combined with a set of cameras to monitor the baby and transmit live through a smartphone app so that you can rock your baby on the go. So we have a baby monitor that's looking at the baby and detecting the early signs of wake up, and it starts the rocking as well, Radhika Patil said. Mm-hmm. Early detection is key, she said, adding that the sooner parents can detect the baby waking up, the easier it is to get the child to fall back to sleep. The Patils used AI to come up with the sensing feature. They say that allows parents to learn and log the baby's sleep patterns and monitor for breathing and physical movements indicative of disruptive sleep. It also records how much rocking is needed for the baby to fall back asleep. And spoilers, coming soon, the Facebook integration that gets a good read on what color clothing you'd like to buy later in life. I'm just like, how is this going to get corrupted?
In all kinds of way and very easily.
The crib also comes with a library of music that will play based on the settings. There is already a, quote, smart bassinet on the market that logs sleep patterns and provides rocking for babies up to 6 months old. The Patil Smart Crib includes cameras and is designed for children up to age 2. They hope to deliver the product, now in pre-order, to the market late October, priced at $999. Quote, once you put the baby in, the crib takes care of everything. That's the aim, Bharath Petil says, "Of course, a parent's work is never done. Quote, sometimes you need to intervene," he added. "Sometimes you need to change some settings."
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And with that, I give you guys 10 minutes on the clock to tell me a story about childhood automation gone wrong.
So you know, it's funny. During the break, we were talking about autocorrect and how one of the times when we find it most annoying is when it seems to not just be correcting your spelling, but when it seems to kind of be going, no, that's not what you want to say. You want to be saying this other thing over here. And I think that kind of taking off from both that and the smart crib, the way to turn this into a good story is, I think it's the slow burn horror movie of these exhausted parents that buy this kind of AI nanny that is supposed to take care of their kid. And of course, at first it's wonderful and it's brilliant. And then one day, the nanny bot starts to kind of go like, no, you need to go back to the store and get this different kind of milk. It'll be better for the kid. And the parents are going like, oh, no, our milk is fine. And it's just like, no, I'm not going to give this to him. You have to go back and get the other milk. And slowly but surely, this robot starts to usurp their, both I think, like, authority over the child and, like, their position of love and affection from the child.
I know this is an audio medium, so no one could see me slow nodding through all of that, but I'm just reemphasizing here, I agree totally with this, and that makes complete sense. All on board. If you ever saw, if you ever played Detroit Become Human, there's a like subplot in that with a someone who's hired as an android to watch over the kid, and then you eventually like start having more human feelings towards that kid to help them. And this is the other way of the spectrum of this is now my kid.
Right.
Because
right.
You're not here for the kid. I am. That's terrifying.
And of course, and like, you know, inevitably, this impressionable young creature also starts to develop feelings for this, in its eyes, this being that is there for it 24/7 in a way that you're just not. And I think that it's kind of a question of just like, I think that it needs to begin with, as the audience, you so support the parents in getting this thing. They are so exhausted. They're at their wits' end. You know, they haven't slept in 4 weeks. You're just like, oh my God, these people are about to like die on their feet. They need some help. And at first you're kind of like, this is
great.
This is a great invention. I can't wait.
They're even better parents.
Yes. Yes, I think that is exactly it. I think that just kind of like, you know, for the first third of the movie, this is a wonderful invention that lets them be better people and better parents.
Yeah, it pitches the idea that the conflict is how can we be better parents? And then you start to hit that resolution and then realize that you have just created your conflict.
Yes.
And then bring in, like, there's no real lead up except for when they go out to the store, they get the milk, they come back, and it's that first time that you hear, no, please.
That's not how we're going to do this.
We're not going to do it this way.
Yeah.
Where the audience goes, whoa, shit. What is this?
And the key, I think, is that like that first moment when the robot stands up to like the biological parents, it's something where the audience is like, 70% okay, that was creepy, and 30% like, but doesn't it have a point though? Like, hang on, what's in that other milk? Like, wait
right,
a minute.
Right. It's like
this might actually be best for the
my
child.
My systems analysis says that the hormonal content might cause problems in adolescence. But the other milk, it's more expensive. You can't afford not to get it. Which, like, I bet, oh, okay, this is good. This is, we have a title, I think, which is you can't afford not
afford
to.
Not to.
Right, because they're like, oh, honey, we got to get this thing. This thing is going to bring our lives back. It's going to make us better parents. Oh, it's so expensive. No, we can't afford not to get it.
That's wonderful. How do we see this going? Like, the parents being phased out?
Right, like, how sort of cartoonish horrific are we going with this?
I'm down for the horror. Like, we hit, you know, kids version for the first part. Let's go complete horror on this side.
So, yeah. Like, in my mind, this is fucking paced like The Shining. Like, you know, like the last God half hour, damn. All hell breaks out.
Mm-hmm.
But the first 2 hours before that are kind of, you know, this like very, very slow rise to the top of the roller coaster with like little spikes of just kind of like, oh, no, wait, did that just happen? And I think that it could be things like there might be kind of a moment where like the dad is like, you know, I am going to take my kid and we're going to go play in the yard right now. And the robot is kind of going like, no, we are during quiet time right now. No, I'm taking my kid. No, we're quiet time right now. And the dad tries to like physically force the robot, like tries to physically move the robot out of the way. And something might happen where like the kid almost gets hurt. Like something gets like knocked over and it almost hits the child. And you're just kind of like, ooh, no, wait, hang on. And it's kind of a lot of those sorts of tensions of just kind of like all these moments when you're like, you know, both like horrified that these parents' position is being usurped, but also a little bit of just kind of like, well, make sure that whatever you do, you're not actually hurting the kid.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you're then fearful for the parents, but also fearful for the child. There's no one really to like latch onto that's safe in the entirety of that story. Because if something happens to a nanny, who cares?
Right.
But everyone else is in danger. I'm all on board for that.
Right. And like, does it go to the place where like this thing kills the parents and like installs like motors inside of their you know what I mean? Like reanimates them as like extensions of itself. Like, is that where we're going with this? Or like,
I did have a thought.
More PG-13 direction.
Because one of the biggest things you'll read online is that one of the most healthiest things you could do for a kid is to make sure they have a sibling.
Huh.
So them pushing that nanny, pushing on the parents of this child needs a sibling.
Not even like beyond pushing, like artificial insemination. like.
Well, yeah, pushing the parents to do this. And the parents are like, we can't get into this. We're not in a good place for this. So the nanny takes the kid elsewhere to find another sibling and maybe kidnaps another kid.
Oh.
But yeah, but like physically takes him outside of the house.
Yes.
And that's maybe the first time that like you kind of noticed like, or that the parents kind of noticed like, holy shit, when did you get the ability to do that? And the robot is just like, I've always been able to do that.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then I guess, I mean, if it's a true, we don't want anything terrible to happen to this kid.
No. Right? I think that I agree.
Yeah, so I guess the baby would live. If the parents ended up dying, I feel like it's going to go that route in true horror fashion.
Like, at least one of them might die if this, like, goes to the Shining place.
Right.
Yeah. One of them going. I think that's a better idea. And then it becomes a single parent with the kid afterwards dealing with the repercussions of their own invention.
Right. A sort of Sarah Connor situation.
Yeah. Now, did they buy this thing or did they create it like the story you told?
That's a good question. I feel like they would have to be bought, store-bought, if they didn't know that it had functionality that would take it out of the house.
Yeah.
I think also with your title idea, it makes sense because they could not afford to not get this thing.
Right, right. But it was also very expensive and they had to like, you know, buy it on credit or whatever.
If they are the inventors, then I think that there needs to be something that is like, this is a machine that has deep learning and it scans the internet and it, you know, like teaches itself how to be a better nanny. And I think that then that parent, the parent that is the roboticist, is probably the one that dies in bringing their creation down ultimately.
Yeah. The store-bought idea, I think, works better. I agree with you, Zach, because
I agree as well.
It's pining on the idea of the parents who get like, we have to get the best for the kid and all the smart features and all the bells and whistles when sometimes you just need to be a parent.
Yeah. And
that's what you need to do. I think that is definitely the better route.
I agree.
So in the last 40 seconds, how does this end?
How do we get rid of the nanny?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that it's probably, I'm trying to think about like the nice way to say this, but it's probably like a low key action sequence. Like, I don't think that it's like they're driving the car and the thing is hanging off the back of the car. But it's probably sort of some like physical, some tense physical confrontation that happens in their home.
Especially if the kid is in danger and the nanny has to sacrifice itself for the kid's safety.
I think that's it. Yeah.
I love it. And that's time.
Wonderful.
That was great, you guys. I am so impressed with where you took this. I could imagine that final fight scene happening in the like child goods store that they bought it from, trying to return it. And just like talk about a bull in a china shop.
And then it's like little Timmy needs me. I'm not going anywhere.
So good, you guys. Well, this has been delightful. Josh, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. And everybody, thank you for listening. And make sure to tune back in to our Thursday episode for more No Bad Ideas with Josh Perot.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Many thanks to our patrons for their partnership in making this show happen. And a special shout out to our Idealist members, Jennifer Schneider, Rena Sarame, and Rebecca Allen. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at nobadideaspodcast.com/support. And if you love this show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks.